Save big money on everything for your next project at Menards. Spring is here, making it the perfect time for outdoor projects. Suncast storage sheds are an excellent solution for protecting outdoor lawn and gardening tools. They're easy to assemble, and the all-weather construction provides water resistance and UV protection. Save big on Suncast storage sheds. View our selection of Suncast products today in-store and on Menards.com. Save big money at
Menards. You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 250.
On today's show, we talk about an early Chinese saddle, Paleolithic rock art, and us.
Wow. Let's dig a little deeper and use some of that horsepower. Welcome to our last show in America.
Well, actually, are we recording like one segment in America and then another segment in Mexico?
We do this all at once.
Yeah. We're like having a very behind week. We've had lots of RV trouble this week, so
yeah,
it has definitely taken away from our time to do other things while we're troubleshooting issues with the RV. However, yeah, we're good to go now.
Yeah, we spent the last 2 days trying to get our inverter working.
Yeah.
And turns out it was fine. It was a switch. Yeah.
So that's good, because the really expensive thing is still functioning and the hopefully cheap thing to replace,
yeah,
that we were able to bypass for now is going to be okay for a month while we're in.
If you ever want to learn how to troubleshoot electronic equipment, it's almost always power. And if it's not power, it's something mechanical.
Yeah.
So.
And that's RV life for you too.
Yeah.
I think I was ready to quit RV life two nights ago, though. I was like sitting here in the dark because we had no power. And
yeah.
Anyway. Yeah.
You know who else had no power? The ancient Chinese.
Well, hold on.
But they had horsepower.
Like, everything you just said is wrong, but yes, let's go for it.
Actually, it's not.
It's not wrong, totally.
Yeah. So this first article is called Ancient Chinese Saddle Surprises Archaeologists.
We get to be surprised today. I'm so excited.
Because every week, I feel like we do an article where we're surprised
or
that it's
shocked,
a gender thing.
Yeah, I know.
Real quick, we've linked to the Apple News article because the Apple News interface is really cool if you have Apple News.
Yeah, we just prefer to read from there. So we were like, why don't we just start linking to those? Because, you know, plenty of other people might be using Apple News too. So, yeah.
Right. Also, if you do happen to be on an Apple device and you click on the Nat Geo article, it's behind a paywall. But if you use a little reader tool in the Safari browser window, then it gets everything away and actually takes away their pay window too.
It did. Yeah. So, a lot of websites are getting around that these days, and the article just stops short and you can't actually read it. However, I guess Nat Geo hasn't done that yet.
Guess not.
Yeah.
All right. What's going on here?
Yeah. So this is a saddle that was found in the Yanghai Cemetery in the Turpan District of Xinjiang in northwestern China.
That's all wrong.
So sorry for all the pronunciation. I feel like I did like 75% okay. So this cemetery is Iron Age, and the saddle has been dated to between 700 and 400 BCE, which is, because I need this number for my brain, about 2,700 years old, which is so old for a piece of leather, right?
Yeah.
So the Yanghai people were mostly sedentary people that herded goats and sheep. And as you can imagine, it is unusual to find the organic remains of a saddle or other riding equipment, like things that are made of leather, basically, because they decay, or leather or hides or whatever. They just don't last.
Leather usually has because it's like cured and stuff, has a little bit more chance of lasting than like fibers from a rope or something like that.
True.
So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And we could find something like that. Also, the shape of the saddle is, like, I wouldn't have known that was a saddle. And
yeah, it is interesting.
Yeah, this is why as archaeologists, when we go out to sites and things, you can't just like, oh, if it looks old, I'm going to record it. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't remember if I've mentioned on this show, but I'll never forget one project I did in Northern California where we had a Native American monitor, and we actually asked him, because he was a kind of a scholar of their history in that area, and he was really well studied. And he told us what we could expect to find and what they look like, because these ear toggles were the biggest thing that they find up there. And those are just like bars and stuff that go in your ear. Mm-hmm. But when they're in the archaeological record, they could just like a, they could look like a smooth river rock.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
And yeah. if you don't know what you're looking for, you might not see it.
You might not see it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I would, I mean, obviously this would have been a human made artifact, but I wouldn't have probably known it was a saddle head yeah. had I not had the training.
The shape is very unique and we'll get to a little bit more on that in a minute. Yeah. But they did know that people were using horses in this region. So we have to make the distinction between horse riding and horse for labor and horse for use, because they found like pieces of bridles and bits, but those are like made of metal, I think, mm-hmm. or other materials well, that would last longer.
They are now. I don't know if they were 2,700 years ago in China.
Well, but they've found more of those.
Ah, okay.
But the thing is that those don't mean saddle or riding necessarily, because you have those if you're leading a horse around too,
sure.
or using it for some kind of work. So this is the first evidence of like saddled riding, which is mm-hmm. really cool.
That's pretty neat. You can always infer that some kind of thing is happening, but until you actually see it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And until this discovery, the oldest known saddles were from the Pazaric culture in the Altay area of Kazakhstan and Russia, which is just a little north of this area in China. So they're actually not that far away from each other, like regionally speaking, very different countries today. But back then, they weren't crazy far from each other.
Yeah. And those saddles were dated to the 5th century BCE.
Mm-hmm, so they're a little younger. Yeah. yeah. Now, the lead author on this study, Patrick Wortman of the University of Zurich, thinks that even though this saddle that they found in China is older, horse riding probably still originated with the Pazaric culture to the north. He thinks that it came in from the north to the south.
Yeah.
I like this quote from him in the article. And he says, horse riding was probably introduced to northwest China from the Pazaric region, and it's possible that saddles also arrived that way. So there you go. That's what he says.
So that's one assumption we're making that's going to lead to the assumption this article is debunking right here. Well, not really. There's just two assumptions I'm noticing here, but they're not mentioning this one, because I feel like archaeologists say that a lot, too. If they don't have evidence of something somewhere, but adjacent, they do have evidence of it. And maybe, you know, maybe that culture is older or something like that. There's always the assumption that that technology or information or idea transmitted to the other culture. Now, there's a massive body of work on the transmission of culture and ideas, but it doesn't necessarily mean that, right?
Yeah.
Like maybe somebody went over there and said, hey, that looks like a good idea. And then I'm guaranteed there's wild horses.
Yeah.
And they just, you know, I mean, you can figure it out.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be, these guys started it and gave it to them.
Very much could have been independently developed. And I think a critique I have of this article is that it didn't go into detail or flesh out why he thinks that even though this saddle is older, the technology still originated somewhere where we don't have evidence of the older saddles. Mm-hmm. And I wish there was a little bit more reasoning or ideas behind why he feels that way, because, yeah, you're right. Like, who's to say it didn't develop independently, or, you know, maybe it was developed in this China, you know, culture and then sent to Kazakhstan. Like I would like to see more of the reasoning. I'm sure there is a reason. It just wasn't explained in this article.
You know what I just thought of too? Archaeologists behave often much like the control room guy in the Chernobyl series. Was that on Netflix or HBO or something?
HBO, I think.
The guy, they kept saying, oh, the reading is this. And he's like, oh, that's not bad. He's like, they're like, as they're saying, that's as high as the meter goes. He's just like cutting them off and moving on.
Yeah.
Well, how high does the meter for leather go?
Yeah.
Right. Like how far back does horse riding and these saddles actually go? Does it go beyond our capability to see it in the archaeological record?
Right. And because of the organic nature of these artifacts, it could go back a lot further and we wouldn't know. We are relying on these super special preservation, things that happen to give us more evidence. But because it requires very arid, in this case, preservation or some other type of really great preservation, it doesn't happen very often. We're going to end up with holes, which is, it makes it hard to fill in. You can get evidence from the art. They cover that a little bit in the article. There's art showing people on horseback from China, but I think it's later, you know, it's not as early as this. So
it's not that much later. There's a picture in the Apple News article of basically a bronze statue with a person riding a horse with a saddle on it.
Yeah.
And it's from 1191 to 1148 BC.
Yeah. So like about 1,000 years later. But so we could hope to find art. We could hope to find more pieces of equipment that would give us a better idea that people were riding. So there's other evidence that could be found, but to find these saddles themselves is really special, and there just aren't that many of them. So it's cool.
But what's the apparent shocking bit about all this?
Oh, yeah. Well, I feel like it's pretty shocking that they found an older saddle in an area that they didn't expect to find an older saddle. But anyway, that was pretty shocking.
Yeah.
But the other surprise here was that the saddle was found in the grave with female remains. Mm-hmm. And it was a female remains that were sort of dressed for riding, too, apparently. Mm-hmm. They had a lot of really great organic remains in this grave. And of course, the assumption had been that horseback riding was reserved for military, and specifically men in the military.
Sure.
And this is a woman. She was not military as far as we can tell, and was probably like doing, you know, herding and things for her communities. It makes you realize that horseback riding might have been much more common amongst all of the people in this region rather than just the military, which is really cool to break that assumption.
Yeah. I like the fact that this is so old. Mm-hmm. Like it's one of the oldest that they found, right?
Yeah.
So, and there's a woman riding it. So like, it's not even like women evolved into riding this thing, you know, culturally.
No, no.
It's probably like everything we've experienced. There's this equality that we just don't realize is there because we haven't found as many examples of it in the archaeological record. And because the people who, you know, discovered most of the original early part of the archaeological record that formed all our textbooks were old stodgy men.
Right.
You know, they so they're making assumptions. These assumptions. Yeah. Even if there was nothing to specify gender, they would have just been, this must have been a man.
Yeah.
So that's how they write it.
Yeah.
And totally. That's just how it becomes.
Yep.
And so
it makes you wonder if there's been any kind of reexamination of the remains and graves that were found in the 1800s and early 1900s when they weren't as good at distinguishing between male and female remains, because that might have more evidence for women riding if they were to do that.
Right.
I don't know if it has been done. They didn't talk about it.
Yeah,
again, the critique of this article is it's a little bit light on the science itself, because the other thing that I felt was missing was like, why don't we have more information about the woman that was in the grave?
Sure.
Now, maybe they haven't done the work yet and that's why. But like, how old was she? Was she found in a larger cemetery area with other remains in a larger community? Like, I would love to have more context around this burial, but they don't provide it. So yeah, they do, however, give a great description of the saddle itself.
Real quick though, one thing I was thinking about was, you know, it's still possible that this was for military purposes, but that the woman was part of the military. And I'm only saying that because the military does not just include people with weapons. The military is an entire entourage of people. And maybe she was a warrior. True. I'm not going to discount that, but she probably wasn't dressed as such. And they know that. But it's possible that she was, you know, running out onto a battlefield or doing something to, you know, help people out or doing something, but it's needed possible. A horse to do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Totally.
So anyway, still could have been military is all I'm saying.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely could have been. I do think that the area they found this in, because I said they didn't say anything about the community, but that's not entirely right. They said that she was found in the Yanghai Cemetery in the Turpan District in Xinjiang. Hmm. So it's a part of a community of some sort. But again, they probably had some kind of military presence or forces of some sort to protect themselves. So, yeah. Anyway.
All right. Well, take a look at the pictures, because they got some pretty good pictures of just the saddle and then also in the burial itself. The saddle itself is made of two wing-shaped hides that were stitched together along the outer edges. It's stuffed with a mixture of straw, deer fur, and camel hair. That's crazy.
Yeah.
And there's a section between the wings without stuffing known as the gullet, which is purposely left that way to relieve pressure on the horse's spine. So
yeah, kind of like, I feel like it sort of like flopped over the horse and that center section was less comfortable for a person to sit on probably, but it protected the horse. So
if there was any sort of stirrup like thing, when you're bombing on a horse, your butt's out of the saddle.
I've literally never ridden a horse.
Yeah. Well, you've seen it.
I have.
They just they do that little bouncing thing. They so they undulate with the horse.
Yeah. I mean, I've watched Yellowstone, so.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, don't look at Kevin Costner's horse riding techniques. He's old.
Oh, I thought he was pretty good. I don't know anything about riding a horse.
Maybe not Kevin Costner's, Harrison Ford.
Oh yeah, Harrison Ford.
He's even older.
Well, they're actually both old.
Yeah. Anyway.
Look at the other guy, Cole, what's his face? He's my favorite.
Oh my God. Let's get out of here.
Anyway. Yes. So this gullet that is protecting the spine of the horse shows an increase in care for the health and comfort of the horse, which in turn would allow the traveler to go longer distances. So really it's like a win-win situation to care for the horse a little bit more. And also, like, you don't come up with that idea right away. So this this saddle must have been further down the line in the development of this. Yeah. There must have been older ones is what that tells me anyway.
They had to realize early on if they take care of the animal that it'll take care of them. So
right.
The materials that it was made from weren't anything special. They were common materials, inexpensive, but very well crafted. You can tell by the stitching and just the layout and all that stuff.
Again, not the first saddle these people had ever made, for sure.
I have a feeling this is stereotyping, but that everything the Chinese made was very well crafted. I don't know.
It's probably a bit of a stereotype, but yeah.
Well, just all the stuff is so good, even like really old. But
so just a couple comments on sort of the horse riding debate in the archaeology world. So both when people began riding horses and when they started using saddles to ride those horses is like hotly debated topics, apparently.
Yeah.
So the earliest evidence for riding horses, either bareback or with just like a blanket or a mat for protection, that evidence is found in what is today Romania, Bulgaria, and Hungary around 3000 BCE. So just a little older than this saddle. So another 2000 years older than this saddle.
Yeah.
So obviously they started riding horses first without saddles, right? Mm-hmm. The saddle emerged later and they just haven't really filled in the timeline for when, where, how, who, which is something that this find is great with helping with, but it does seem like they just need more evidence to know who developed it first, if it was done independently or if it moved from one region to another through technology transmission. So anyway, I think there's just more work to be done and more debate to be had because, archaeologists love a good debate.
Hey, there you go. All right. Well, that's about enough for this. So we're
kind of like waxed on about saddles here, didn't we?
I know.
It was a cool article, though.
Well, let's ride on into the sunset and end up in Spain and talk about some cave paintings. Back in a minute.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Welcome back to episode 250 of the Archaeology Show, and we're in Spain now talking about cave paintings.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're cave paintings.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why are you so skeptical? Can you see the picture?
Yeah, I can see the picture.
The picture is kind of hard to see exactly what you're looking at, but yeah. Check out the article. We've linked to it as usual. It's in the Smithsonian and the name of it is Just How Old Are the Cave Paintings in Spain's Cova Donés?
Yeah.
And Yeah. I mean, the picture is a little bit amorphous, but don't you always kind of find that like rock paintings are like that?
And yeah, they can be a little abstract, especially older ones.
We're not calling it rock art anymore, right? Like, isn't art out?
I've heard rock drawings. I've heard various things because art encompasses a connotation that there was some sort of, you know, artistic thing going on.
Yeah.
But like, it could have just been communication.
It could have been. It could have been spiritual. Yeah. It could have been any number of things. So
we just don't know.
Calling it art is kind of adding something to it that you don't necessarily know for sure. But so this group of paintings is really, really cool. So Covadonis is close to Spain's eastern border in Valencia, and it was first explored in 2021 by Aitor Ruiz Redonado and his colleagues from the University of Zaragoza in Spain.
First explored, really?
Yeah. Like, this is the first exploration. Now, maybe people knew about it and it just hadn't been fully studied.
Yeah.
That they did not go into detail about that in the article. But yeah.
Yeah.
They found at least 110 paintings, drawings, and engravings in this cave. So that's a fairly solid amount of I keep wanting to call it art, but we're not calling it art anymore. Drawings, I guess. Mm-hmm. That's a solid amount of work that they found in this cave.
Yeah, and most of this dates to at least 24,000 years ago, and we'll get to a little bit later why they think it's at least 24,000 years.
Yeah.
But the motifs that they found, and motifs is just shapes. It's a scientific word for shapes.
Yeah, like there's panels, which would be a cluster of the drawings together. And then motifs would be the different types of things within that. I think
I think the definition of panel depends on what kind of surface you're looking at. In the context that I know I've done rock art research was, I mean, it literally is the face of a rock. You go to another face, that's another panel.
Right.
Right. If you got a solid face along here, you don't really have panels unless you can define geologically, you know, like where the edges are. Anyway, it doesn't really matter. But they found a whole bunch of stuff, and the motifs that were on there included female red deer, wild horses, and now extinct oxen.
So one unique thing about these paintings is that they were made with clay, and most rock art from this time, I'm gonna just call it rock art, whatever. Most rock art from this time was made using ochre or manganese. Those are just like the common materials that we find in paintings from, you know, Paleolithic times like this. However, these were made with clay. So that made them different and interesting. And like, how in the world could clay even preserve on a cave wall?
Right.
So, yeah, there's something very special going on here. And that is how it preserved. Yeah.
Well, this particular cave is karstic, they call it. And that just means that the walls are rich in calcium carbonate. And calcium carbonate acts as a natural sort of paint preservative. Now, I saw them write that in the article, but like, how do you define the word paint in this context? Like, because they're literally just using clay, and the clay is a different color than the wall, and it dried. You know, imagine your hands getting all just like muddy and you're drawing on something, right? I mean, that's essentially what it sounds like what they did. But there must have been some natural pigments and things in there because it was opposite of the wall, basically. And and then the wall, the calcium carbonate in the wall helped to preserve them, which we'll talk about.
Yeah. Are you like objecting to using the word paint because that implies like art, I guess, a little bit,
not necessarily. To me, paint is something that's prepared, like ochre. Like, you have to prepare red ochre, right? Like, you have to grind it up and usually mix it with some water. You don't have to, I guess, but usually that's like there's a preparation method. Paint is something that nature doesn't provide.
Well, it does sound like they were doing some kind of preparation because according to the researchers, they would likely have scooped the red clay from the floor or even, you know, pulled it off the walls of the cave and then mixed it with the water that was also found in the cave to sort of make it into this. I imagine it was almost more pasty than paint like. And then that's what they used to create the images on the wall. So I mean, that is kind of a preparation, right? To like purposely take the two things and put them together like that.
Yeah. I guess I just don't think of clay as paint sometimes. I mean, it has a color.
Yeah. Well, like, think about like watching the pottery throwdown. And like they use a slip is like basically a clay that goes on and it acts as a paint essentially, especially after they fire it. Right. So I think it's kind of like that. But
well, through this whole process, they were recreating basically a minerally reinforced paint, they called it.
Yeah.
Because of the calcium carbonate mixing with the clay and the minerals in the clay.
Yeah.
And just like hardened the crap out of it.
Yeah. Like over time, the water that was still rich in calcium carbonate was dripping down the walls and mm-hmm. over these paintings. And rather than washing them away, it like kind of sealed them in. And that sort of crusty stuff that was left on the paintings mm-hmm. is what they're hoping to date when they do the like lab analysis of yeah. the paintings, which they have not done yet. So, yeah.
Yeah. And since they haven't done that yet, you might be wondering, how do they know it's at least 24,000 years old, which yeah. is where we get into relative dating.
Yes.
And we do this a lot with different things. So relative dating is just dating something else that you know is true. And therefore, this can't be, you know, it can't be earlier than this date mm-hmm. because we know these things maybe were gone at this date. So what did they find?
Yeah. So there is a cave bear claw mark across one of the paintings. Mm-hmm. And this is a species that went extinct 24,000 years ago. But they were able to determine that the rock art predates the bear claw mark.
Right.
So because of that, they can say that, well, this had to have happened before the bear made the claw mark. So therefore, it is at least 24,000 right. years old because the bears went extinct. So that's how they're doing that.
We use that to date rock art sometimes, too, just by what's depicted on the rock art. Mm-hmm. If they depict something that's now extinct, you're like, well, I mean, the rock art had to be at least as yeah. old enough for them to be alive.
Yeah, it has to be at least this old. And that's what you usually do with relative dating. You're saying yeah. it's at least this old, but it might be older because of the things around it or whatever, right. like you said, they're depicting. It sounds like there were some other extinct animals that were included in the imagery as well. But I think the cave bear is the oldest thing. So they know it's at least this old. And,
right.
you know, I think the range, given what items are being depicted, is actually like 21,000 to 40,000 years ago, the article said. So it could go back even further than that
yeah.
once they do this dating technique and if they get good solid dates from that. So
nice.
It could be a lot older, which would be really, 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 really neat. So hopefully they get some good dates off of that.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, with that, that's a relatively short one, so we're going to end it right there. But we talk about tools a lot in archaeology, don't we?
We do.
Like, we talk about tools a lot. We're going to talk about some real tools in the next segment. Back in a minute.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big money on everything for your next project at Menards. Spring is here, making it the perfect time for outdoor projects. Suncast storage sheds are an excellent solution for protecting outdoor lawn and gardening tools. They're easy to assemble, and the all-weather construction provides water resistance and UV protection. Save big on Suncast storage sheds. View our selection of Suncast products today in-store and on Menards.com.
Save big money at
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome back to episode 250 of the Archaeology Show. I've got fans that love me saying that.
No, they don't love it. It's annoying. Nobody loves it.
I'm going to make a t-shirt that says "the" on the front and Archaeology Show on the back. So you got to wait for it.
I don't know why I'm so against it. I think because you're annoying.
Anyway,
yeah.
So we actually had more than a couple of emails in our time doing this with people saying, well, we've had a few emails where people are saying, don't talk about yourselves.
You guys are so chatty.
Yeah.
Why do you laugh so much? I hate you. Go away. And I'm like, that's cool.
Bye. Get to the archaeology. You suck.
Yeah.
Also, we've had some saying they wanted to know a little bit more about us and our lifestyle and what we do like mm-hmm. for a living. Right.
And probably like our background and how we got to where we're at. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this isn't going to be like an extensive history, but we actually met on an archaeology project. My first one, technically, mm-hmm. my first CRM project.
And your second one.
Yeah.
If you want to count that meeting, I mean, we barely talked, but yeah.
Randomly, we showed up on the next project together.
Yeah. So really, it was my third, your second.
Yeah. That's where we got to know each other.
That we really became friends.
That was in downtown Miami.
Which I know we've talked about on this show a lot, because that site keeps coming up
yeah.
over and over again. It's so crazy. It was like almost 20 years ago that we worked on that project so together, crazy. But yeah. it's just, they keep developing down in that area in mm-hmm. Miami, and they keep finding more things. And then it brings up the same, not the same site that we were on, but the same cluster of sites
same
that are
culture.
That, yeah, that are related to that culture yeah. that we were excavating the Tequesta. So anyway, yeah, that just keeps coming up.
I know, that's a cool project. My roommate ended up becoming our best man or, a groomsman.
A groomsman
for me.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we just, yeah, we met some really good friends on that project. Like you do on long-term archaeology projects.
You do.
A lot of archaeology
yeah.
projects aren't like super long. But if you start seeing people at various projects, like if you stay in the same area, you get to mm-hmm. know them. But a lot of times if you bounce around the country, kind of like we did in our first few years, I mean, you don't get to know anybody unless you really stay on a project for a while.
And I can't even believe I'm going to say this right now. The CRM archaeology crew, podcast crew would freaking kill me for saying this, but part of the reason why we got so close and is because they made us share rooms.
Oh, yeah.
And that is so, so not okay these days.
Yeah.
It is not okay to make adults share a hotel room on a project just to save money unless they are in a relationship together. That is not okay.
Right.
But it is what they did to us. And like, we all became besties because we were living in each other's pockets.
Out.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel
yeah.
like I got really lucky because my friend Sean, who I had met on the project before, he was kind of my dig buddy on a unit
mm-hmm.
and to get show me the ropes because Sean had been doing it for a while at that point.
Yeah.
He's very different than me, but we're also very similar in some cases.
Yeah.
And it was just it was great. I had no complaints
yeah.
having sharing a room with him.
Yeah, you guys were good. My roommate was we were okay. We just were different people and that's
yeah.
fine. So
But we
were great friends while
yeah.
we were there. And yeah, I just can't even believe I'm giving like a plug in favor of sharing rooms. But that really did help like force
yeah.
all of us into a great friendship. And even the people that we weren't sharing rooms with, I don't know, it's like because you needed to get away from the person in your room sometimes, you
yeah.
ended up going to hang out with other people more than maybe you would have if you could just be alone in your room. So
right.
anyway, yeah, it was a fun time.
Well, let's fast forward a lot
yeah.
and jump over the highlights here. So we split ways on the end of that project as things happen.
Mm-hmm.
But shortly after, in the fall of that year, we kind of got back together on another project working together. And then we just started kind of staying together. And
yeah, I like it. He needed a job and needed to get out of Vermont where it was just like wet and rainy and muddy.
Yeah.
So I hooked him up with the company I was working with, and he came down and had nowhere to stay in South Carolina, so he slept on my couch and then, you know, never left. So then we got married 5 years later.
Now we live in a car. Yeah, so
we live in a vehicle.
We live in a
not
car,
a car.
We live in a car in a trailer park.
Anyway,
yeah.
So that's how we ended up getting married, and
yeah.
now we're still together. That was in 2011 that we got married. So
right.
we've been together, I don't know, 18 years,
something like that.
If you count to the beginning. Yeah.
I said fast forward.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Sorry. Well, we're
yeah.
18 years later. Here we are.
No, but I want to give a little bit of our archaeological history. So
yeah.
we both did shovel bumming. It's called, where you just project to project.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, we stayed in South Carolina for about a year and a half
mm-hmm.
working for that same company. And then when we decided we didn't want to work in the Southeast anymore, we basically sold both our cars and bought a Toyota 4Runner. And then
mm-hmm.
Packed everything in it that we could live in a hotel room and camping gear.
Mm-hmm.
And then we started working our way west because you can't just, unless you get lucky, you just typically can't just jump massive regions if you don't have experience in that region.
Yeah, we did get kind of lucky because we went to Ohio first.
Oh, yeah.
And then
the
we
New
jumped.
The Mexico project was lucky.
Yeah, we jumped all the way to New Mexico from Ohio. And
yeah.
honestly, again, it was shared hotel rooms. They weren't paying very much and they wanted us. That this is our theory, and we're not going to say who the company was. It doesn't matter at this point.
Yeah.
This was 12 years ago, but they liked us, and I'm pretty sure they hired us because we were a couple, and they could
stay
save
in the same
on.
Room.
Yeah, we would stay in the same room and save them
yeah.
on a hotel cost. So,
yeah,
and it was a benefit to be that for them. So anyway,
yeah.
that got us to New Mexico, and then from there, that was a great project. We got to
yeah.
go all over the Southwest. We really found out how much we loved being in the West. I think
yeah.
at that point, the Southwest specifically.
Well,
and
if I'm not mistaken, the New Mexico project before we went there, that was our opportunity because Sean was subleasing our apartment, I think, for a little while
oh,
in
yeah,
South
he did,
Carolina.
Didn't he?
And then
yeah.
when our lease is up, I think between Ohio and New Mexico, that's when we got rid of the apartment and put everything in storage.
I think so.
Yeah.
Because
then we headed out in your Elantra with tubs on the roof, Rubbermaid tubs.
Yeah. The 4Runner came after that.
I guess it did come after
yeah,
that.
Yeah. I can't remember the full.
Well, whatever.
It doesn't matter.
Whatever happened, yeah. We didn't get the 4Runner until we went back to South Carolina, because I know we bought it there.
Yeah, we did.
Oh, I know what happened. Okay, so here's the timeline. So we did shovel bumming in her car for a while.
Yeah.
And then,
oh, yeah, we sold your car and just had mine.
We sold mine and we just had hers. Yeah. And then we were doing shovel bumming all over the place. And at some point, we ended up through a bunch of projects in the West and in Nevada, up in Washington State over the winter, kind of doing a project. And I had applied to grad school, and this was 2009 mm-hmm. at the University of Georgia. And I got in, or 2008, this would have been. And I got into grad school, and then we found that out over the winter there. And then eventually we moved all of our stuff back to Georgia. And then that's where we were, Rachel flew back and was doing work back in the West mm-hmm. while I was in grad school. Cause my grad school program was only a year. It was an accelerated program. Normally mm-hmm. they're 2 years for a master's
degree.
It
was like summer to summer. So you had summer, fall, spring, same number and of summer. Yeah. It was basically like 2 years, but crammed into one.
Yeah. A lot of people, and the way they do that is because you had to bring a research project with you, but they did have some research data sets that hadn't mm-hmm. been written up yet. So I didn't have to do all the archaeology. I just had to do the analysis and the write-up, which is really what your grad school education is about.
Yeah.
Especially for a degree like this. It was a master's in archaeological resource management. So they're not, I mean, there's a lot of theory and stuff, but you don't have to go, you know, dig up some pottery site in the West or something like that. You know, you're really learning how to do your thesis and the research and the theory and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So anyway, after grad school, we went back to Nevada.
That was your grad school, not
that
me.
That was my grad school.
I'm just a lowly field tech with just a bachelor's degree. And I still am. And I'm okay with that.
I don't know how I do it. But anyway.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, so then we went back to Nevada and we still kept on doing CRM, and I started my own company, DigTech, in 2011 or 12, something like that. Mm-hmm. And then not long after that, I started, or maybe even before that, I think before I started my company, I started the CRM Archaeology Podcast.
Yeah.
And eventually, I mean, I kept doing archaeology. You kind of went another path after a little while.
I did. I worked in like customer service and order picking, I guess you could call it, order fulfillment for a yarn company. Cause I think I've talked about this before on the podcast, but I'm big into knitting. I love knitting anything really. And I design patterns on the side too for knitting. That's, if you follow me on from the show notes, that goes to my knitting profile basically, which is all the knitting stuff that I do. Yeah. So, which I very rarely post on. So probably don't go follow me there. But anyway, so that's what I was doing for like 8 years. I worked for them and I got a totally different skill set there, you know, leaving. I just was like burnt out on shovel bumming. It was a lot. You're always moving, always. It's just constant moving and you never feel like you're making enough money. So like, it's just like such a drag after a while, at least it was for me back then. So I moved into this job in Reno where I didn't have to move so much, working with yarn, which is my second love, you know, I loved it. So that was great for a while, but then I left it when like right before COVID happened. Separate from COVID, not because of it. It was a planned thing that I had been doing, but then COVID did happen and all of my skill sets came together, if you like. So I wasn't working at first, but then WildNote, which is who I'm currently working for, which is a field data recording software. You know them because you worked for them for a little while too. And they knew that I was looking for work and that I had customer service experience from my time working in the yarn industry. So it's like all my skills came together. So now I get to talk to archaeologists about the work they're doing and help them figure out how to use WildNote, the app, to record that data in the field. So it's like this perfect mixture of my skill sets, which is what I'm doing right now. And I freaking love it. So it's great.
And in the meantime, right after you quit that job, it was during COVID, I think we did our first year of that big project out in Eastern Nevada.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Because we bought
the last
RV.
Bit of field work that we've done.
Yeah. Because we bought our RV and then used it for that field work. In before you quit that job, I had projects and occasionally you were able to find some time and they would let you go to come work with me on those. So you kind of kept your toe in archaeology a little bit.
Yeah.
But I kept doing the field work and stuff like that. And eventually, I mean, you mentioned I worked with WildNote. I actually brought archaeology to WildNote because I was actually working with another company before that. Mm-hmm. And that relationship. I didn't like where the company was going. That relationship kind of soured a little bit just because we weren't happy with the directions. Mm-hmm. And then I knew about Wild Note through some other things because I'd actually interviewed them on a podcast on an episode because I knew about their field data recording software. And then they brought me down to San Luis Obispo and we talked about archaeology. And now they're doing archaeology. But before that, I actually had an investor and a partner and we were working on building our own field data collection app. But turns out you can't do that with just $50,000. It costs way more than that.
A lot more.
Yeah. And then before that, I was actually developing my own archaeology site forms through a third party application that was available that allowed some really good form building stuff that and I was actually selling occasionally, not much, but those forms that I would build through that software.
Yeah. You've been in the digital field data collection world like for a really long time. Way ahead of the rest of the industry for sure.
And this kind of goes to where we're at now. I kind of get bored of field work.
Yeah.
Field work is fun. You get to hike, you get to go out and do stuff. But in the end, it's like, where's my intellectual stimulation here?
Yeah.
It's just like, it's kind of all the same thing over and over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And
a lot of finding nothing, which is important for archaeology. You have to find nothing to show when you do find something, the importance of it, you know?
Yeah. And a lot of people love this lifestyle.
Yeah.
They love just doing that.
It's great for people. Yeah.
So, but I needed more. So that's why I started doing all the digital stuff and then really focusing on other types of things in the Archaeology Podcast Network, like the Archaeotech podcast.
Yeah.
And we got kind of glossed over that. I started the Archaeology Podcast Network 9 years ago, and that's going strong. So, So I had this co-working space in Reno where I had an office just because I needed a space away from home because Rachel was at work all day and I was at home alone and I just wanted people to talk to and, you know, do that kind of thing. So I had this co-working space and eventually I had an office mate that worked for this company that was doing something completely different. It was similar to WildNote in what I was doing in form creation and project design and stuff like that and just doing these little things.
It's data entry.
But creating the space for the data entry. Mm-hmm. But it was for a completely different industry. And so I started doing that. And now I'm kind of doing that full time.
Yeah.
And then the Archaeology Podcast Network is also what I'm doing full time with all the producing and stuff like that.
Although I do all the editing for it these days, which has worked pretty well. So if you notice anything weird in any of our podcasts, editing wise, it's my fault. Tell me, because I am trying to improve. I'm not as good as Chris, but I'm getting better, I think, with time and experience. So,
Yeah, that's pretty much where we're at now. We're trying to develop a few things on the side. I don't want to work for this other company forever. Mm-hmm. Got some other things I want to do. As the podcast network grows, honestly, that's the direction we'd like to go. But
podcasting
become a member.
I know. The membership really helps us to like gain independence and do this full time. And it's just so fun. Like this is why I became an archaeologist, is to talk about really freaking cool stories like the saddle or the cave paintings. And I know we're coming at it from a surface level, but it's just so fun. And this is, we love sharing this information and it's the kind of archaeology that we're enjoying doing now.
Well, and I'm not trying to, I didn't intend to do this when we started talking about the segment, but I will tell you with more memberships, you know, we have 100 members. You know, and we don't really promote it that much and it kind of fluctuates. Some people drop off. Some people we get new ones. But if we had 1,000 members out of the 1,000,000 people that listened to our shows last year, we could do so much.
Yeah.
Right. And we want to go around to archaeological sites in this country and abroad and interview people in the field and doing things like that.
Yeah,
but there's just no funding for that.
Yeah.
So we have some possible things coming up this year that we're not talking about yet because we don't know about if they're going to happen, but we might be being sent to other places in the world to do things, which is really cool.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not paying for that. And that doesn't happen very often. It's just kind of random that it's taking place, maybe.
Yeah.
And it's still a very big maybe. But I'll tell you what, these little memberships that cost you as much as a Starbucks
coffee
latte, really help us out to get these things done.
It helps us so much. Yeah, for sure.
All right. Well, with that, we will see you guys next week. Thanks.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.archpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland,
DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.